5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This episode of Hacks and Flacks was recorded in mid-November 2022, when formal complaints were made against Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab for behaviours during his time serving in Boris Johnson's government. Beer sales had been banned in Qatar ahead of the 2022 Men's World Cup, and Amazon announced that they were to revive Australian soap Neighbours 4 months after its final episode was aired on Channel 5.
Hello and welcome to Hacks and Flacks with me, Petri Hoskin. Hacks and Flacks is the only series where you'll get the inside scoop on how journalist hacks and the flacks of government and business work behind the scenes to decide which stories you'll be reading with your morning coffee, and perhaps more importantly, how they keep certain headlines off the front pages. What happens if a public figure is a subject of a salacious story? When does a scandal make or break a career? And how do you really know what is or isn't fake news? All these subjects and a whole lot more will be explored by me and a regular panel of hacks and flacks, ready to spill the beans and tell us how the sausages get made. Flacks like former government advisers Giles Kenningham.
Hello.
And Andrew McDougall.
Hello.
Plus hacks like Mick Booker.
Hello.
So now all the gang's here, let's delve into the world of hacks and flacks. Hello and welcome to Hacks and Flacks with me, Petri Hoskin. Now, I've spent my career interviewing people from every political spectrum and in some cases putting them through their paces, often to the dismay of the special advisers, or SPADs, whose job it is to make sure the politicians in their care come out on top. But what if I harboured aspirations of working in government myself? It seems a well-worn career path, as we often see journalists announcing on their social media that they're leaving their current role in news to go over to the dark side of working as a flack in Westminster. Well, as usual, I'm not alone, and I'm joined by two former agents of the dark arts, Giles Kenningham and Andrew McDougall, who I'm hoping can coach me in achieving my dream job in Westminster. Well, it's not really a dream job, I don't think. I haven't spent
not
many
much
nights.
Job security there.
Yeah, I haven't spent much time dreaming about it. But what are the main skills do I need? And why is it that journalists seem to fit this bill? Giles, I'll come to you first.
Well, there are typically two forms of special advisors, a media one and a policy one. And as you said, the journalists often end up doing the media one. I think the skill set has changed for what makes a good special advisor. When I was doing it, you really needed to have a forensic understanding of the newspapers who still set the agenda and the broadcast media. But now it's much more about understanding multiple media platforms as the media has fragmented more and more, and multiple stakeholders and how you bring consensus to that. So I think that's one sort of skill set. The second one is an understanding of how to run a campaign and to sort of generate interest and maintain interest and build, you know, as I said, a consensus and support behind what you do. You've got to have a good understanding and knowledge of crisis comms. I think the sort of big mistake that, you know, sometimes happens with journalists crossing the floor is they can be incredibly tactical and think, oh, great, I've got this great story in the Daily Mail, but it doesn't suit your overall strategic objectives, or people get spooked and blown off course by a story in The Sun and The Telegraph, which, you know, once upon a time, it did move the market and it was a big issue. But now I think you don't need to worry so much. And I think your own platforms are much more important. So, you know, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. And as Prime Minister, as a government minister, you have a ready-made audience where sometimes you can put your own stories out on those platforms, bypass the traditional media. And that is probably why they've now appointed Amber de Botton as a director of communication. Who has a TV background. You know, it is a much more important medium for them. It traditionally used to be all they wanted was someone with a newspaper background because they set the agenda, but that is sort of less the case now. So that will be their thinking about digital first, which is, I think, in the world we live in, eminently sensible.
Yeah, look, I don't think being a journalist gives you any particular skill or insight into being a special advisor. Well, look what we had a journalist running the country until not too long ago. How well did that go?
Yeah, true.
And it also, I guess, shows you that the state of the news business now, where people feel that leaving a potential position of influence, say that Amber had with Sky, to go in to what ITN. She was with Sky before, I guess, right? And to go into that environment where, you know, they've been hiring and firing prime ministers quite quickly in this country. So that kind of shows you the decline on one side, but also the allure of working in politics, where instead of a journalist, you can influence the debate, but you can't really get things done. You might get a scalp or two along the way, but you don't really get a chance to move things. And I think people who cover politics, in particular journalists, really do care about the country and the policy that's happening in the country. That's why this allure is there, but I don't think it gives them a skill set. Like, just even my own course into government, you know, I kind of fumbled around in my 20s trying different careers and doing things and ended up writing quite a bit, which is how I got into government, which does speech write. And eventually my boss said, do you want to have a crack at press? And I said, well, I've never done press before. Is that a problem? And he said, no, I can teach you that. You get the politics. You get how things move, how issues happen, how the kind of coalition arrays against you and the stakeholders work. If you understand that, I can teach you the mechanics of how to brief a story, you know, how to suss out where a journalist sits on any one issue. That stuff can all be learned. And I don't think, like, maybe being a journalist gives you some insight into your own bias on that front, but I don't think it's a skill set that you poured over.
I mean, that brings me to the question, really. Does a SPAD have to believe in the policy, in the party, in the politics in order to do their job properly? I mean, would a Tory SPAD, you know, journalist, go and be a Tory SPAD?
I mean, I think you need to have a sense of some sense of belief and conviction in what you do. But I mean, to this point, Craig Oliver, who was the director of communications when I was in number 10, apparently had voted Lib Dem the 2010 election, right? So he wasn't some blind ideologue. I don't think having someone who's like blind in their ideology is good. I actually want people there who will kick the tires and who will question stuff. And that is fundamentally the problem with the Labour Party, has been that if you don't agree with them, you're evil. So basically, they're writing off half the population by doing that. And also it shows a lack of empathy. So I think there has to be an element of belief, but not blind belief in what you're doing.
Do you have to believe everything the government is doing? No. I mean, I certainly didn't when I worked in government. Does it make it uncomfortable sometimes when you kind of have to put your lips to a policy like signing kind of a trade deal with China? Look, I hate China. That's the government people. That's not the people of China. I love the people of China. Well, some of them. But the government I'm opposed to. And so, yeah, it grated to have to defend that. Or, you know, we abolished the long-form census to pick a weird policy. Like, I thought that was a dumb decision. But I went up day after day for months on end defending that dumb decision. But that's my job. And it's funny how people can't separate that. You know, you talk about, especially in the world of social media, where people think you are your boss and they can project all of your boss's sins on you.
Yeah, as a journalist.
You know, and even to this day, 9 years after I last worked for a prime minister, I write newspaper columns and I still get like the, well, that's not what you said in government. I'm like, but I wasn't me in government. I was them. That's the job. My job as a media SPAD is to present the government's position, to vend the government's position. It's not that I have to believe in it.
But isn't that very difficult to do if you really are against a policy?
Well, if you're getting the shit kicked out of you, Petri, by the press, it's awfully hard to defend. If you know you have a bad line on a bad policy that you don't care about, but that's where you prove your worth. You go in and you do it. And you don't get a get-out-of-jail-free card. Well, guys, you know, this isn't my policy, but, you know, you're there to take the bullets. You're the flack. That's why you're there, to take the incoming.
But as a journalist, Giles, you know, we feel that there is integrity in what we say and what we do and in having a balanced view of something. If you're up defending a policy that you really don't agree with, I don't know how you could do that. I would find that incredibly difficult.
I mean, I didn't really have so much of that issue. Sometimes I would not agree with the strategy which we were rolling out and thinking, actually, we should do a U-turn on this, or we should go this way, or we shouldn't be actually reacting to this or playing to this game. You know, for instance, I think one of the things which, with hindsight, in government we did wrong is we commented on too many things. You know, we're expected to have a view on everything. It's like, why does the Prime Minister have to have a view on everything? He doesn't. Actually, this is not the nanny state. Get on with it. And, you know, there was that kind of default of like, well, what's the government going to do about this? And actually, sometimes they're going to do nothing, you know, and people actually couldn't get into that. But also remember, you know, the Prime Minister's got to get on and do his job, you know. Yeah. Actually, there's this kind of thirst for him to be constantly on the media. It's like, if he's constantly on the media, he or she can't be doing their job. But it's very hard for anyone now to row back from that, because obviously this precedent's been set. And we now have social media. But I do think potentially one of the ways around that is by using their own platforms, because all the national media will pick it up and will chase it. I know that's something you're going to see more and more from Sunak, which is an intelligent thing to do. And of course, when you have the incumbency of office and the great state, you can give people a view behind the curtain, which is going to be often of interest in a way that Keir Starmer and the Labour Party can't do. And you've got to really think about, if I was in there, how are you going to max out the benefit of the incumbency and look prime ministerial? And there was that. I mean, this is kind of the proper thick of it moment. But Ed Miliband had a real problem with looking prime ministerial. So during the 2015 election, one of Labour's tactics was to have him behind a lectern anywhere, right? There was a picture of him in a garden, in someone's back garden, with a lectern. There's a picture of him in a field with a lectern. And literally, that was kind of one of their ploys. This will help. And obviously, it's quite farcical, but they did struggle with that point, was that people didn't see him as a prime minister. And, you know, Cameron, they did see as a prime minister, but also then he had the benefit, the incumbency of office, and to be able to be on the world stage and look like a statesman who was representing his country effectively.
And maybe that's where having a journalist as a spad might have stopped Ed Miliband from doing something so stupid.
Yeah.
There's a thousand reasons a prime minister or politician would prefer a podium. It gives you something to center, gives you something to put your
hide
water
behind.
You say that, but there is a comfort that there is something between you and the opponent. But yeah, sometimes and when you have somebody who kind of comes at these things from the kind of stock standard, podium announcement, whatever, get some stakeholders behind you. Like often, like how many times do politicians look dumb when they line up a human backdrop behind them? And sometimes it's just not the day for that. Like if the prime minister's going to be getting a lot of angry questions about a tough issue, you don't want a panel of kids behind you. But like somebody like us will go, well, the kids will soften everything and it'll look great. But then you look like you're putting kids through misery, and then one of them yawns, and then one of them falls over, and then suddenly that's a story, which actually might be a good thing. But yeah, you do need that orthodoxy of views in any political office. And this is where maybe if it is incestuous between the hacks and the flacks in this, you really do get quite a bit of groupthink. So like, why not get somebody from completely outside the universe of Westminster to come in and go, look, everything you're doing
is
kind of shit and stupid. Like, why don't you do it? And to Giles' point about technology, like, it's probably going to be some TikTok meme guy that is the next director of communications at number 10, because TikTok meme guy is the king of the world. And think about that for a second and then vomit and then think about it some more and vomit again. But anyway, we're going to be obsolete is what I'm trying to say.
What happens when a spad knows that everything's going wrong with a story and you're desperately trying to advise to change direction or to do something different and nobody's listening to you? Does that happen?
All the time.
Yeah.
I actually quit because I was tired of... I decided to leave because we were on like month four of drip, drip, drip on a scandal story, and nobody kept listening to me about like, we got to do it this way.
Really?
And it was just like, I'm not going to get my face kicked in over this anymore. I've done this for 5 years. Well, 7 years in total, but 5 years with the prime minister. I'm like, it's time to go do something else, because what's the point of me if you're not listening to my advice on this? And this is the thing, and I'm sure Giles will tell you the same thing. Everybody and their mother is an expert in communications in government. The policy guy, expert in communications. You know, the tour guy, you know, expert in communications, like the person that fills the water cups for the cabinet meeting, expert in communications. And they tell you everything about how everything should go. And too often they don't defer to communications expertise as expertise, which it absolutely is. So policy people out there, stop doing that, please. Just stick to getting, I cannot make your bad policy better with good communications. You know, I can certainly help blunt the impact, but give me better policy. I'll give you better comms. When you think about it, like, who are we to be doing that even? Like telling a government to abandon a policy? Like nobody elected me to do that. You know, somebody hired me and is paying me government money to advise on communications. I think you've seen ever since the days of Alistair Campbell, probably the kind of augmentation of the importance and the mythology of the SPAD as somebody who actually calls a shot. And certainly it was the case in Canada where I was a SPAD. And I had probably more influence over the government of Canada's direction than elected MPs.
Wow.
And well,
but isn't that a bit of a worry?
Well, yes, absolutely. Yeah, because accountability, nobody elected me to do that. And I didn't feel good. But some people, you could tell Dominic Cummings is just like, yeah, this is my little personal plaything.
Yeah,
he's
yeah.
like Elon Musk with Twitter. He's like pulling all the levers and going,
that's
oh,
why you
do
can't
this.
Become the story, because eventually you're going to go.
Yeah.
You know, with Cummings, it was death by a thousand cuts. But as soon as he'd become that lightning rod, you could see the inevitability that he would have to go at some point, because then people are saying exactly like, well, hold on, I didn't elect you, you're not accountable. And I think for every special advisor, or mostly if you are eminently sensible, you never want to become the story. Because if you do become the story, usually you have to go. And, you know, of course, everyone is expendable in politics.
Yeah, here's the rule of thumb. If you have to go out into the garden of 10 Downing to give a press conference as a special advisor, you should have already gone.
Yeah, and exactly. It's like when the spokesman needs a spokesman,
yeah,
it's time to get on the bus and bugger off. And yeah, you know, I think I had a couple of times when, you know, something I was like, oh my God, am I going to get dragged into this? And I wasn't, but yeah.
Does it not become a bit incestuous, the whole, you mentioned that word a little bit earlier, in that, you know, if you have journalists then becoming SPADs and all their friends are in the other camp, they're all press or journalists as well, and there's favourites, and you know, how do we know that, you know, Amber de Botton isn't going to just give all the work
to
ITV and, you know, and not to any of the other broadcasters, or show favouritism? Does that become a problem?
I mean, yeah, you do have those rows which erupt every now and then. You know, our big one was like, the Mail could never stand a Telegraph getting something, or vice versa. They saw themselves as kind of arch rivals. You know, you had the Sunday Times versus the Sunday Telegraph. So you do get those rows which erupt about why didn't we get something when the other person got something. And there's this constant inherent tension which is going on. I actually think inherent tension is good, because everyone's got to have their feet held to fire. And I say tension in the fact that the Red Ship can't get too cozy. But I don't think you can really survive doing that job or effectively just giving it to one outlet the whole time. And it still remains the case in number 10 in a job that the BBC is incredibly important. You know, it
still
is the most trusted news brand in the country, and it has multiple outlets. So it's not just what's on Radio 4 that then gets ripped off and put on Radio 5 or on the Radio 2 bulletins. It still pulls in. I mean, you know, not what it once was like 30 years ago, but I think the six and the 10 are still pulling in 4 million.
They are, the sixes, yeah.
And don't forget that often other people then follow and chase what's on there. So that's why the governments get so obsessed with the BBC, because it is still the benchmark.
Tonight's meal, tilapia surprise with boiled cabbage. Begin cooking steps 1 through 50 now.
Are you kidding me? Making dinner shouldn't feel like doing a 1,000-piece puzzle. With Blue Apron's new one-pan assemble and bake meals, the hard part's already done. Pre-chopped ingredients, zero stress. Just assemble, bake, and enjoy. No complicated steps, no mountain of dishes. Try assemble and bake today. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Talking of the BBC and specifically the Today programme, those figures are falling, as we know. But it also struck me, or whenever I listened to it, my brother used to be one of the investigative journalists on it. It just seemed so inward-looking. It always seems so Westminster-looking. I wonder if their figures are just from politicians listening to each other as opposed to it getting out into the wider...
Yeah, and I think there is. I remember having a huge argument with them about cuts. So when is a cut not a cut? When is it a saving?
Yeah.
So they came at it from this public sector mindset. Everything was a cut. I'm like, well, it's not a cut if the frontline service is not be affecting. Heaven forbid there might be some waste which might need to be exposed.
Yeah.
And also the fact that cuts would have to be like done in a salami slicing way. And it's like, well, actually not. I mean, when I worked in government, one department I was in was the local government department. And we were the first department in 2010 to roll out the cuts, really big cuts, 20% plus. But you know, that was the sort of necessity of the economic circumstance. But you're speaking to the BBC and like, well, why can't councils club together and you have one council, say, for all of London doing rubbish collections? Oh, but you can't do that. Why not?
Yeah.
Why can't a council have a coffee shop in there so it's more profitable, take the money and they can buy some books? Why have we got council libraries procuring on their own?
Yeah.
They've got the buying power of W.H. Smith. Oh, but, you know, it's never been done like that. And they would just go from X to Y. So you're right, the mindset, and this is the real danger of the group think within there, is coming at it, say, from a public sector perspective the whole time and not actually thinking how you can use, sometimes, not all the time, in government, the private sector can be really helpful, but being more intelligent about how we do these things.
Well, just even more regional representation too. And I think it is incestuous, it is. And there is that group think about how they see the game of politics. Like, you know, we're here chatting as Hacks and Flacks, as two sides of that.
Yeah.
That same coin. And you do tend to only see the coin. And it's one of those things, like, if all you have is a hammer, every problem is a nail. And really what we're missing in politics writ large is that diversity. And I think that's why when you see some of the more effective journalists that come to Westminster, it's a compliment place like the Yorkshire Post or some of the big regional dailies that are still there. And their attitude is not. And we saw that when Truss got her head kicked in on the regional media round. Is like, yeah, they're not any less a journalist. In fact, quite often they're better journalists because they're not sucked into this game of access. And just one point for the SPADs listening to this. If any particular paper starts whinging at you about not getting something somebody else got, I would just say, well, no, you're not getting the next one either. So keep complaining to me.
Yeah.
You know, I know how to do my job. Shut up. It was a better choice this time. You'll be a better choice another time. Stop complaining to me. And this is particularly like the financial
keep,
wires.
You've got
it was
to
like,
keep the press suite, haven't you, as well? That
they,
is
they
also
still
makes
need
it...
you, right? And you have to remember that you can either be honey, you can be vinegar. I was more honey trying to work with people. But sometimes people just need to know that, look, I set the rules in this place. You know, there is no complaints department.
Mm.
And you do that knowing that there's no loyalty from them to you either. You might be friendly to each other, but if they need to burn you for a story because it's that good, they will burn you for that story.
Wow.
You know, I wouldn't say that they wouldn't do that unadvisedly, but if the story is that big and you know, you always have to assume that you know, if the listeners remember Star Trek, there was always the guy in the red shirt that was expendable.
He was always
you knew he wasn't coming back from the mission. And as long as you start these jobs as SPADs, knowing that you're wearing the red shirt, to Giles' earlier point, you are expendable. And there is nobody that isn't expendable, especially when you work for a prime minister. Like, they're not going to, you don't sacrifice the king. You know, you're the pawn. You might be an influential and effective pawn, but you're still a pawn. And you go. So don't get sentimental about it.
When, Giles, have you advised on a story, if you have, and it has gone against you? Has there ever been a time when you thought one way and then you thought, no, this is the right policy, this is the right way to do this?
I can think back to one campaign we were doing where I underestimated the number of different vested interests around a policy. And we took a very front-footed, aggressive approach to it and probably underestimated the volume of opposition or vested interests we would have with it. But I do think it's really important in politics to consensus build. You're never going to please everyone all the time. But, you know, the things which people hate, they hate being surprised, they don't really like the Big Bang approach, you need to explain what you're doing bit by bit, which was one of the problems with the economic reforms which Truss tried to roll out, was they didn't explain them, they didn't consensus build, they didn't say how they were going to pay for it, and it spooked the markets. The markets do not understand politics, they react violently one way or the other, but it's probably the first time, I don't know, in decades that the markets have bought the Prime Minister down, but there was a huge level of hubris there but also the basic 101, you know, build a consensus, lay the pitch, as they say, around what you're doing, and don't shock people. And often, you know, the worst thing is shocking people. Once they understand what you're trying to do and where you're going, they're a lot more amenable to it, which is what you've seen Jeremy Hunt do the whole time in run up to the sort of financial statement.
Well, leaked it all, you mean?
Yeah, expectation management as well. Leaking it, saying, look, there's a bitter pill to swallow. Here's the medicine, you're going to have to take it. But expectation management is really, really important, especially when you're dealing with the media, isn't it? With debates, it wasn't about who was the better person. It was like who had outperformed expectations. Yeah. That's the irony of it, right?
Yeah. And if you expect less, they do better.
Yeah, so actually just managing expectations as you go through. It's always like, you know, under promise and over deliver was always a good mantra to follow.
What about when a SPAD who's come from television or radio then wants to return to broadcasting? There's a few that I can think of, but is there a question over their journalism, really? Because you can say, well, you were a Tory SPAD, so how can you?
I think that the crossing the floor in the first place, that can be a career choice. It's really the choice to go back that, to me, is the more grievous sin. Because you know, even if a SPAD can have different beliefs than the government, you'll never convince your readership or audience of that if you go back.
Yeah.
And look, it's one thing if you were to go from say being in Boris Johnson's government to then, you know, Mick's not here today, but like going to GB News where somebody's kind of stridently more to the right wing of the spectrum, it might be a more comfortable fit and the audience might not question that. But if you want to go back to kind of a broadsheet or neutral reporting after having served as an advisor, I don't know why you would expect people to believe that your biases aren't in your reporting.
I mean, it does happen. Like I say, I can think of some examples, but I do think it leaves you open to attack, doesn't it?
Mm.
Even if it's unfairly so. So I think, to Andrew's point, go back as a commentator, as a talking head, but to go back as a straight reporter, I don't think it's feasible, and I'm quite surprised when I see it that people get away. Because also then, you know, as a SPAD, you just throw it back at them, go, I don't trust you.
Yeah.
We all know where you're coming from. Your allegiances are quite clear. I mean, you know, we had this issue of Jon Snow, former Channel 4 presenter. Let's not beat around the bush. Huge Labour sympathiser. He was going on holiday with Peter Mandelson when he was Channel 4 news presenter. Quite frankly, I think that's unacceptable. Totally unacceptable, because as a Tory politician, you'd be like, John, like, we all know why. We know where your sympathies lie. And it's very hard for the programme then to have a semblance of neutrality and objectivity. And as we know, Channel 4 really struggles with this. Why half the government doesn't bother going on there, because they're much more of a campaigning outfit than a objective news programme. So I think there are issues there for, you know, you talk about, like, you know, the relationship between, you know, journalists and special advisors.
And you can get too close as a journalist.
Yeah, there's one thing like going for a drink. Yeah, going for a drink and a meal. Okay. Well, that's kind
of part of the
course. Yeah. That's part of the course. But I think going on holiday oversteps the mark. Like, once you've left, okay, fine. But I do think there's an issue.
And this is what you see, you know, the kind of allegiances, and everybody in Westminster knows who's friends with who was best man at whose wedding and who's married to who. Like, it really is quite, and I think, yeah, to Giles' point, look, part of our job as media SPADs is you have to build a relationship with a reporter. You go for a coffee, go for a drink, have dinner. That's all fine. But what makes it more difficult now, Petri, is with social media, the kind of barrier for that kind of stuff coming out. And the ordinary person could see someone like Giles and myself with, you know, a Chris Mason and go, oh, they've just briefed Chris Mason the story. Well, no, we've given Chris Mason our version of the truth, if you will, or what the government's trying to achieve. He then balances
alternative facts.
Yeah, exactly. And then he then balances that off with other stuff and he reports it. That's his job. It's not because we've been seen speaking together that I have automatically breathed the word of God into his ear, and he goes and faithfully repeats that. And there's that lack of hygiene and literacy amongst people. They just see like correlations, causation kind of thing, and that's not how it works. But yeah, like if you're showing up on a holiday.
Having said that, it's harder to pass a brown paper envelope over or to leak stories these days because everyone's got a camera phone, right?
Yeah.
So often every now and then, just, every year and a half, DMs. The process story would erupt in Westminster about who briefed that story, you know, where did it come from? I think now you've got to be very, very careful if you are going to do that. But yeah, to Andrew's point, you have government being done by WhatsApp, which I'm not sure is necessarily the best way of doing things, and obviously raises questions about accountability and transparency.
Oh, I remember, just a funny memory, I literally, like, one of the only brown paper envelope briefings I had was because there was, the government was getting done on Indigenous files at the point, and it was our version of the BBC that was hammering us. But we'd actually had the results of an audit of a particular band council come through, and it was devastating. And we're like, if we give this to a right-wing paper, they'll just think that we're smearing poor Indigenous band. And this is where I had a good relationship with one of the reporters at the CBC, so our version of the BBC. I said, he'll do this fairly. He's followed this file. He'll read this audit. He'll know that it's not some sort of hit job. And if they report the story, then other people will follow it. But I had to arrange to meet him in the west end of town, like 10 kilometers from Parliament. Literally, he was gassing up his car. And I drove by into the gas, the petrol station, sorry. And kind of the cars passed each other and like the window went down. And I actually put the envelope through. And it was like, okay, now somebody could still do us in this day and age for doing that, but they would have to recognize us through the car. And like, but yeah, it was 10 kilometers away.
Not a dark garage then at night.
No, it wasn't quite. It wasn't quite deep throat. We didn't have cute names for each other. It was just yeah. No, but I did feel a little naughty for doing it. But then the story came out, and
here's the irony. I always thought the best way, you might have a story which no one's got any interest in, right? The best way of getting out is to walk up Downing Street with your folder and have a piece of paper on the top. And it's put like confidential at the top. And everyone then starts writing it as an amazing story when it's normally complete bullshit.
So it's always the Daily Mail has obtained.
Counterintuitive, just like flipper kind of, because that was the photographer. I mean, that was always a thing coming out of Number 10. You're always worried, like, I haven't got anything on show, because there was a photographer permanently there who would just capture people. And of course, it's human nature. Every now and then, someone forgets, or, don't pick your nose or whatever, because they would always capture. I remember being snapped going in one morning, and I just thought, like, death, walking in, like
Monday, as we called it.
Yeah, and I hadn't been out the night before, but I sort of like death.
Let's move now to the politicians themselves, who fancy themselves as TV celebrities.
Mm. Or
Mike Hancock, most of them. Yeah,
it's showbiz for ugly people.
Showbiz,
right?
So yeah. There are so many that have crossed into. Well, I'm not going to say journalism because that is insulting, but they've crossed into presenting, perhaps, or shock jock territory, or there are certain radio companies that will call Clegg or Beast Boris or whatever it was called. I don't can't remember.
Beast Boris, that's a new one.
That's a good one.
Yeah, we should own that one.
Yeah, we should own that.
Trademark.
One. That's ours.
Trademark accent. Yeah.
And they do really well. What I mean by that is they get paid really well to go on and. But again, everything.
I'm trying to think, apart from Matthew Paris, who went from being an MP to a journalist, and I think he is a brilliant, thoughtful journalist, and obviously does a lot of broadcasts.
I agree.
I can't think of many who've had a long shelf life in the UK. Feels like in the US.
Farage, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose Farage is making a transition. Yeah, that's a good point. And he's been, so far, I think, quite successful. But there aren't, can you think of any other? I suppose Ed Balls. I mean, Ed Balls done a bit of both, hasn't he? Sort of dipped his toe in, so he's done the Strictly Come Dancing, and he's been a good case study in someone who's managed to reinvent themselves from being, I think, perceived to be quite a polarizing figure to now. Here's a question mark though.
The man most famous for Twitter searching his own name and posting it.
But here's a question:
imagine that on the gravestone.
He's a presenter on GB on Good Morning Britain, and you sort of think, well, should he be? You know what I mean?
Well, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, it's this point on people who've crossed over. So, I mean, they do that. So you've certainly got to be, you've certainly got to have a counterbalance to it. But, I mean.
As ever, it depends, right? Like, you could see somebody like.
There's a thirst
like,
for these people.
You could see somebody like Michael Gove whenever he decides to get out of the active ring of politics, given the breadth, the depths of journalists before, multiple positions in cabinet, very thoughtful on issues. Like, you could see how he would be beneficial to have in the public sphere as either a presenter or a contributor to bring that experience. Like, if Matthew Paris could do it as a backbench MP and bring that kind of thinking and acumen to commentary after, there is a role for it. But, like, is it Nadine Dorries kind of, like, we saw how well that went the other week.
Yeah. Like, well, and Matt Hancock, we
turns out like walking and chewing gum at the same time
because
is difficult.
At this present moment, of course, there's an ITV program going out with Matt Hancock in it.
Oh, really? Is there?
Yeah. And his.
Does it involve sheep vagina?
It does involve.
Sorry,
that.
I just wanted to say sheep vagina on the podcast. We all know why I'm here.
He was going to eat the whole thing as well, and then he was told he didn't have to.
Like every man, he just quit. He quit halfway through.
So anyway, he looks like he's seeking redemption, and I know we're doing a podcast on that subject as well, but. Or we've done a podcast on that. But his girlfriend as well has turned up and quit her job. And it looks like they're both going to go for a media career.
Yeah.
What makes these people think that a media career is that, A, easy to get and B, easy to hold on to?
Well, I think people...
It's arrogant.
£400,000.
Yeah, £400,000. And
that'll do.
If you are a politician, you like being in the limelight. So, you know, there's obviously an ego thing about seeking that limelight and carrying on.
100%, right. This is about celebrity and infamy.
It's not about journalism.
No,
it's not about...
God, no. No, remember, he's in the jungle to promote dyslexia. Like,
and he,
number
has he
of
mentioned
time,
it once?
Well, he
to,
might
to
have
be
done.
Fair,
he might
the producers
might, be
might
edited
have
it out,
screened it right. out. They only have half an hour of genius to find out of every 24 hours, right?
That is very, very true. But can it ever be, do you think, I mean, you mentioned Matthew Paris, but is it ever acceptable even that this is seen as a career after politics?
Well, I think to Andrew's point, some people can offer some really good insights.
But as commentators rather than...
As commentators, yeah, not as a journalist, but actually explain. I mean, if you look, Ed Balls and George Osborne are on this sort of Andrew Neil political show on Channel 4, and I think they genuinely do offer interesting insights, and they have a very perceptive reading of things. So, you know, and therein lies something. You know,
but that doesn't seem to be what they're aiming for. What they're aiming for is...
Well, it depends. Yeah, I mean, they've basically got other jobs, you know, but you're saying that Hancock, is he just going to basically try and launch himself as a media personality off the back of this? You know, like you say, does he then get... the radio show, you know, back in the day you'd get the newspaper column. Obviously that doesn't happen so much now. They're not as lucrative. But I think it's few and far between who make it who have longevity. Well, you might have their moment in the sun.
It depends your intention though, Petri, right? Like part of the reason we're doing this podcast is because we have particular experience in a process that a lot of people I think find confusing and mystical and get wrong. And so what we're trying to contribute as former participants is that insight and understanding so people get a more accurate and better view of it. That's a good use of ex-politician's time.
Yeah.
To say, look, like you've not been in the room making a budget when you have to make these decisions about how this kind of stuff is
done.
Yeah,
I'd love to have an insight.
And we need more of that. And I think the trouble we're running into, as with everything now, is this kind of buzzsaw of the information economy we live in that doesn't upweight or prioritize that.
Mm.
It wants a sensational. It wants the Matt Hancock in the jungle. It doesn't want Michael Gove explaining the ins and outs of housing policy to people who are frustrated that they can't buy a home. You know, that doesn't travel or sell well in the information environment we're in because it's not discerning. And that's a large part of the problem.
Well, I've got a little challenge for you both now. Mm-hmm. All right, so we agreed to bash Boris. There's Cool Clegg. Mm. What do we do with Matt Hancock?
half-cocked? Half-cocked?
Yeah, half-cocked, half-hour, yeah. More Matt, right?
Doormat. Yeah. I don't know. Anyway.
All right, we're going to have to work on that one. Here we go again. It's time for PR cock-up of the week. And who is getting the rosette today?
I'm going to give it, like, to the FIFA Firefest that's going on in Qatar, who today, you know, at the day we're recording, banned beer sales at a football tournament. Like, fuck me. Like, it's already bad enough you've killed slave labor to build these stadiums in a hot country that nobody wants to go visit and see. And now you're going to take away the one joy every football fan has.
Is anybody surprised
beer
by
before?
This?
No, I mean, they shouldn't just,
I mean,
like...
really?
Anyway, like... Yeah,
but that's a good one. Giles?
I think the whole, you know, as of this recording, the Dominic Raab allegations around bullying has been handled in quite a, well, cat-handed way. And now he's put himself forward for an investigation, which, you know, you look at those things and think, this is now move the story on. You know, it's only going to probably, well, potentially end one way. So I think, you know.
He's wearing the red sweatshirt, everybody.
You could be like.
I think there's quite a few wearing red sweatshirts.
So you've basically guaranteed now this story is going to be going on for the, like, 3 or 4
How
months.
Should they have handled it?
If it genuinely is the case that he has not been bullying anyone and he's been stitched up by the civil service, he's come out and give a full and frank account of what's happened. Yeah. And do it. So now I don't feel like I've given you that, and I've got nothing else to say on the matter. You know, but this is what some people do. Like in a crisis, they go like, you know, sometimes they go, oh, I know what we'll do is we'll say we're going to have a report and we'll kick it into the long grass. But it always backfires. Now, obviously, sometimes there is a case for having reports and investigations because, you know, due process has to be done and people have to be held to account. But I can think of times, a lot of times when it just, you didn't need to have an investigation where it's totally backfired. So yeah, I think it potentially is credit rolled off his own back.
But ultimately the tactic has to suit the subject matter, right? And look, if you know Dominic Raab, presumably he's not just been an asshole once in one time to one person, right? Yeah. You know if somebody's quite brusque or rude or angry with their staff. So you know, well, if one person said this, chances are there could be another 10. And do I want to defend all 10? And then you go and you have a very hard conversation with them and go, look, have you done this to... And you don't... Like the departments that he's worked at will all have these stories. That's why they're all coming out now. Is it part of a coordinated campaign? It doesn't matter because you can't win against that by using process going, oh, it's unfair the civil servants are bringing this out. It's like, yeah, but he's being a dick.
Yeah.
Like that's the problem, right? And your process concern doesn't trump the fact that he's being a dick. And so you got to figure out how much of a dick he's been to how many people. And then you act and then you give your advice. It's like, and if he's so
another
important.
Another high profile resignation though. I mean,
but yeah, if he's so important to the political project, then you take the decision that we're going to brazen it out. And
but this doesn't also, this doesn't look good on Sunak either, does it? Because he said he was the man of integrity and he said he would sort it out. Gavin Williamson threw himself on his own sword and said, look, we'll find out. And so that saved Sunak having to get rid of him. And this now looks like Sunak is not a man of integrity.
I think for him is that, I mean, no one's going to remember the Gavin Williamson episode of the next election. But if you get a few of these, the critical mass of it builds up. I mean, look at Partygate, right? One party on its own wasn't going to bring down Boris, but it was the critical mass of things, a drip, 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 where the momentum became so great that there was only ever going to be one outcome for Boris. So I think that's a danger for Sunak, and that is a danger after 12 years of government, is they are, the thing they will be fearful of is kind of, you know, the sort of position that John Major was towards the end of his tenure, where actually the economy was going really well, he turned it around, but people were like, nah, done. Had enough time for change.
All civilizations fail.
Yeah, exactly.
End.
Like everything. Yeah, everything comes to its natural end, and so that will be their big fear at the moment.
Guys, thank you very much indeed. And on that note, it's time for me to say adieu. This is the final episode of this series, Hacks and Flacks. From scandals, social media and super injunctions to reinvention and redemption, the last 10 weeks have been a wild ride, and I'd like to thank everybody for joining us. But that's not the end of the story, because we've barely scratched the surface. So I'll see you again. Goodbye for now. Hacks and Flacks is presented by me, Petrie Hoskin, produced by Amanda Redman, and brought to you by Trafalgar Strategy. If you want to get in touch with your take on the current news climate, you can do that by emailing us at hackflackpod@gmail.com. And don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time on Hacks and Flacks.